bicycle crash is not an accident. And when you find yourself in a situation that calls for experienced, effective, and positive legal support and advocacy, you can depend on any of North America's independent Bike Law members. Bike Law's cycling attorneys are members of our community committed to the pursuit of cycling safety and justice. For more information about Bike Law, log on to bikelaw.com. They're on your left, protecting your rights.
Time for The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist on-air show is heard every Saturday morning, 7:30 a.m. in Northeastern Ohio on WJCU 88.7 FM and streamed at WJCU.org. Our weekly podcast is available at the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com or download it with your favorite podcatching app to listen anytime. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. This is our show for August 1st, 2020. As we continue to see COVID-19 taking over our lives in so many ways, we are also seeing events, companies, and people who want to carry on with some semblance of normality coming up with great innovative and imaginative ideas. Take my first guest this evening, Rolf Smith. He's an award-winning photographer and writer who has worked with National Geographic for decades. This year, he's pretty much grounded, and so has come up with a fabulously creative way to use his bicycle to tell his photographic story. After we speak with Rolf, we're going to head to Minnesota, where People for Bike's Noah Bannion, the federal affairs manager, is sheltering in place while still attending to her work, mostly out of D.C., Noah shares some great news, which we can all use these days, about the always-in-process transportation bill, a new report from the U.S. House Select Committee on the Climate Crisis, and an upgraded commuter reimbursement deal for cyclists. With the cancellation of so many events, and Sea Otter being the place that is often used to launch new products, the people behind the scenes have been working to put together a smashing new idea, Sea Otter Play. And we're going to tell you all about it. Well, my original conversation with Rolf Smith was supposed to be about his article in National Geographic about the history of the bicycle. But as I delved into his work, which is beautifully artistic as well as technically brilliant, I wanted to know more about the process and his thinking. Here's our conversation. Hello, Rolf. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thank you for being my guest this week. I really appreciate it.
Well, it's a real privilege. I'm actually delighted to be here.
Well, you are actually in the UK, but you normally live in Australia. Is that true?
That's correct. Yes, I'm from all over. I was born and raised in New Hampshire in the United States. I emigrated to Australia many years ago and became an Australian citizen, which I've been for decades. And then I married an English woman that I met on my big bicycle trip around Australia. And I've been living here in Hastings, in the south coast of England, for the past few years.
Wow. So you're sort of the globe-trotting guy.
Yeah, kind of. My two children have triple citizenships as a result. They have three passports, which is quite handy for whenever they want to travel.
Well, MI6 would like that.
I'm sure they would, yes.
I'm sorry. I couldn't help it. So what brought me to you was the piece you wrote this month in National Geographic, How Bicycles Transformed Our World. But as I delved into everything that you have done, which is tons and tons of stuff, I became very fascinated with the work you're doing using your bicycle to sort of define landscape. So we were talking before we actually went on the air. If you would be willing to do that, tell me about what you're doing and how that process works.
Well, I've always loved the image of a bicycle on the landscape. You have a human treading lightly. It's a sense of escapism, freedom. And I wanted to capture that. It's something I've seen artists do a lot. If you look for cycling in art, you see, because artists have that freedom to create a landscape and then put a cyclist on it. It's so much harder to do that as a photographer. I suppose if I had painting talent, I would probably be doing that instead. But I'm reasonably good at photography, and so I started to make this little project of shooting cyclists on the landscape. And the cyclist is me. I go out very, very early in the morning to get the best possible light, and I am my own model. I try to anonymize myself to the greatest extent possible because I don't want these pictures to be about me. I don't want them to be selfies of my bike rides. I want them to be a cyclist, you perhaps, anybody. And so I do a lot of quartering shots, away shots. I use cycling caps that have the brim dipped to try to obscure my face just slightly, not outrageously, but just to try to make it about a cyclist on the English landscape. And we have some lovely landscapes over here for cycling.
These photographs are breathtaking. And so can you tell me a little bit about how you technically put yourself, and the one I'm going to, let's talk about, this one interested me. It's called Nighthawk, and it's actually in the city somewhere in this beautiful sort of cafe or restaurant, and there you are sort of coming upon it.
Yes, that was I'm a fan of Edward Hopper.
Ah.
And I love the sort of his use of human beings, again, in a landscape, in a stark landscape, in this case, and that sort of sense of melancholy, after hours, solitude. And when you cycle, as you would know, you've done a lot of cycling yourself, you notice things. You see things that you never see otherwise. And I was riding along the seafront in Hastings, where I live, and came upon this corner, and I thought, my gosh, that's Nighthawks. And so I set up my camera and tripod and created this image. As you say, technically it's kind of tricky to do. A lot of people ask, well, how can you do it with yourself in the pictures? That technical part is fairly straightforward. You get a tripod, you get a camera, and a programmable shutter release called an intervalometer.
Okay.
That part is easy. I mean, anybody can set up a camera and you get yourself in the frame. But the harder part is you have to see it, the vision, the image you want. You have to see in your mind's eye. You have to see it before you do anything. And then the tricky part is getting yourself precisely in that frame, right where you want to be. And it's much harder than it looks because a few inches sometimes either way can make or break the shot. So you have to be spot on where you want to be. You have to be, in the case of Nighthawks, it was very low light. It was like night.
Right.
You have to be going very slowly if you're going to have any kind of sharpness at all. Fairly high ISO, but not too high. You don't want it really grainy. So you have this really delicate balance, and you have to ride very slowly, still be exactly where you want to be. But you know how hard it is to be on a bicycle and get the body language right so that you appear to be cycling in a sort of carefree way down the road, when actually you're gripping the handlebars really tight and trying to go as slow as you can. You're thinking about all the things that you need, where you want to be. There's little bumps and lumps in the road. You have to have the wheels looking right. You don't want your wheels twisted. There's so many things that can go wrong, thousands of things that can go wrong. And in the middle of this, of course, it's a completely uncontrolled environment. So you might have everything going perfectly fine in some truck blasts. there's no end of things that can happen. So it can be very, very stressful. And I sometimes see a certain irony, and I come back and look at my pictures, and I look like I'm just, lyrically blowing my way down this beautiful English lane. And I'm thinking to myself, how completely stressed I was trying to go. It's quite tricky. And then, of course, I do a lot of stuff with out in the marshes with sunrises and mists.
Yes.
I'm fortunate enough to get a lot of really nice mist, and there's lovely light out there. But there again, you have the sunrise, and you need to be just exactly right for that sunrise. Your positioning has to be perfect. You have to know where the sun is going to come up. So I research these images quite a bit. I have little lists of roads that I know where I can go to at certain times. I keep a track of the sunrise times, the weather forecast, the state of the tides, the phases of the moon. All these things all go into this. Plus, again, a lot of research, a lot of prowling around. Right now I can tell you exactly there's a spot on the road which will be right directly into the rising sun on this particular road. And I know right where to go for that for this month. That's going to change next month. Next right. month I have to move something else. Wow. It's a big job.
Well, I know my listeners are going to want to see these. So before we get off the call today, I will make sure that they can. So a perfect example of you needing to know exactly where you are supposed to be. There's a photograph called Low Tide at Hastings.
Yes.
And it looks like you're standing on the water. You do have to have that vision. Do you ever have to take anything twice, or can you only ever get one shot at these?
Oh, yes. Yes. Sometimes, you know, you think you've got it, and you come back and you check the screen, and I'm a perfectionist, and I get really wound up about it. But you look and think, no, wait a second, you know, the wheel is wobbling, my head's not right, I'm looking down, you know, all these little things. And so, yes, assuming I have the time, I mean, I have to work really quickly in some of these things because the light is changing by the second.
Right.
So I get back, I look very, very quickly. And it can work both ways. Sometimes I think I've had absolutely nothing. And I come home really down, and I start editing things because I will have taken many takes because I'm positive I've gotten none of them. And I see that I've got them all. And I think, well, I've got all this repetition. Other times I come home feeling really chuffed. You know, I got that one, nailed it. And I look at it and I think, oh, dear. You know, I'm not getting that sunrise again. I'm not going, you know. And, you know, sometimes you just get out there and you just find that I've guessed wrong. I've imagined something and I get out there and I mean, I leave sometimes at 3 o'clock in the morning to get where I want to be on my bike in plenty of time. Cause our sunrise is, I'm in England. We're at 51 degrees north. So in the summer, our sunrise is at 4:40.
That's pretty early.
Oh, it's early. And you know, if you want to be somewhere 10, 12, 15 miles away at 4:20 in the morning, so I want to be there well before sunrise, you know, you got to leave really early. And nothing is quite so heartbreaking as when you come home having done all this and you just didn't get it. That day just didn't work.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Rolf Smith. He is an award-winning magazine writer and photographer, longtime contributor to National Geographic. I found him through an article he wrote, and we're not talking at all about that article right now. These photographs are breathtaking, and I know a lot of my listeners are also photographers. They love bikes and cameras. And so I want to ask you a little bit about this bicycle, because it looks like a very traditional steel road bike, bar end shifters, fenders, lights. What kind of bike is it, Rolf?
It was custom made for me. I'm good friends with a very well-known frame builder over here in England, a guy named Mark Riley, who makes just some absolutely lovely bikes. Now, he tends to make more racing-type bikes, but I commissioned a classic lug steel tourer, and you know, it's an old-fashioned bike. It's got the TA quill pedals and it's a quill stem. Very traditional touring bike, and I had it painted in a sort of a light mauve color because I do a lot of early morning shots, and I just liked that color. It sort of went well with the morning. That was a bit of my own indulgence. But then I also have make sure to have white tires, because they, again, will show up where I need them to show up sometimes, and I want silhouetted.
Well, I'm partial to steel lugged frames. I'm from the old school myself. Steel is real.
Yeah, and the lugs are just beautiful.
Yes, they are. They absolutely are. I guess we really should at some point talk about this article. What made you write this article? It's called How the Bicycle Transformed Our World. I know it takes us back into a lot of history that we've talked about on this show before, but what brought you to this article?
Well, it's something I've always been interested in. I'm friends with some frame builders over here. I've edited a couple of books on frame building, actually. And so I've always been interested in how this got, how the development of it. Frame building is almost like working class sculpture. I'm interested in history anyway. At National Geographic, I do a lot of archaeology, a lot of history. So if you mix that with cycling, you've got me, definitely. Now, cycling is becoming big again because of this whole COVID crisis, and a lot of people are taking up cycling. And I was thinking about the first time people took up cycling, and it was a game changer. And perhaps, hopefully, cycling can come back and maybe be something more in people's future.
Yes, we should only hope. Actually, over here, we're having not only the bike boom, but we're also having an issue with getting parts and bikes. So I don't know. How is it over there?
We are too. Mm. It's become a very, very big thing, which is nice. And I've noticed, no one else is out when I go out in the morning at 3 o'clock, but on my way coming back at 6 o'clock, 6:30, I'm seeing a lot more cyclists on the road than I had before. A lot more. That's encouraging.
It is encouraging. It's really, really nice. So I guess I'd like to know what besides this series you're doing, and are you just doing this series for yourself, or is somebody looking at this? I mean, some of these images need to be put into a book, Ralph.
I want to do that. That's something I really want to do. I wanted to build up a good enough stock of images, which meant sort of going through all four seasons, which I've done now.
Ah, okay.
And one of the winter, one of the spring, one of the autumn, so I have a good collection. But that's something I very much want to do. It's been a real kind of a labor of love. It's almost like a second job, really, because I have to go to bed early to get up on time, spend 4 hours out on the road from 3 o'clock to coming back at about 7, and then spend another couple of hours editing the images. I would like this to lead to something, but at the same time, if it never did, I would still do it. I absolutely love the artistry of it and capturing this sense of being free and on a bicycle.
Both of those things, free and on a bicycle. Right now, we can certainly use that. You know what? We're going to take a real short break, and when we come back, we're going to talk with Ralph Smith some more. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We are back. I'm Diane Jenks. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist, and we're talking with Ralph Smith. He is an award-winning photographer and writer. Much of his work, I should say, is in National Geographic, and way beyond that. You wrote a book called Cold Beer and Crocodiles. That's so awesome. What a great title. Tell us about that book.
Well, to tell you a little bit how I got interested in National Geographic, when I was 14 years old, the May 1973 issue of National Geographic arrived on our doorstep. And in it, there was an article about a big bicycle boom in America and a smaller accompanying piece about people cycling the Alaskan Highway. And I'd already imagined that I could go anywhere in the world on my bicycle. And there it was in Kodachrome, proof that you can actually take a bicycle and go places. And I resolved one day that I was going to do that. Real life took hold, and my career went all over the place, but eventually it came back around, and my very first story for National Geographic was the story that became Cold Beer and Crocodiles, the book. It was first a three-part series in the magazine. I had been working for Time magazine as a senior writer, and I just decided it was time for me to do something different and actually live up to some of those schoolboy dreams, if you will. One of which was to go on a big, big cycling expedition. I was living, working in Sydney, and I put my stuff in storage, put a few things on a bicycle, and headed off into the bush. I was gone for about 9 months and covered about 10,000 miles completely solo, I was in no rush. I stopped at mining towns, Aboriginal communities, all kinds of adventures, if you will, along the way. And I knew people at National Geographic, and I was sending letters back to a senior editor there. And I hadn't realized that my letters were being passed around to other editors, and they were enjoying them a lot. And as a result, I got my first stories in National Geographic, a three-part series on this bicycle trip, which later became a book. And that launched my now 24-year career in National Geographic.
And the book is still available?
I want to re-release it. I took it out of circulation myself. I had some issues with National Geographic's book division. So
okay. We can leave that alone if you like.
Yes.
Okay. We can move on. Let's just move on to the next topic. It's just, this is just all fascinating to me because it all comes together right now at a time when people really could use some, first of all, entertainment, something to take them away. These photographs and your journeys, you know, you could sort of vicariously live them by following your blog. So are you finding the work you're doing outside of this difficult? What is it that you're able to still do?
Well,
that doesn't take you, you know, like out of lockdown.
Well, I mean, my last assignment, I was in Ecuador shooting a series on the world's greatest Panama hat weavers, which actually just ran in the New York Times this week. And I returned home to Britain literally just a day or two before the lockdown. I've done several assignments off my kitchen table that I've been able to do without going anywhere, including that bicycle history. There's been a couple of other stories I've done. But it is, yes, it's obviously very difficult. If you're a travel writer, travel photographer, I mean, I call my images here that I've been posting on Instagram and on my website, Journeys at Home, because that's really the extent of my travels these days. Otherwise, my work is stuff that, you know, is historical stuff that I don't need to travel for. And I'm hoping that will change soon. But
it's interesting that the work you're doing still looks like travel, you know, even though you're not, you're probably not going very far, but when you look at these images, it looks like you're really far away. I mean, of course, I don't know your area. I don't know England like that. For anybody who wants to know, it's called Journeys from My Doorstep, and out he goes in the morning and takes these amazing photographs. But I know you're working on other things. Do you see when you might be able to get back on the road?
There was one assignment that I've been tentatively offered that would require a lot of globe-trotting travel, and that I can't see happening for the foreseeable future.
Right.
I have a couple of potential assignments, assignments here in Britain, which, yes, should be able to be followed up within the next few weeks, hopefully. But, you know, the globe-trotting things are definitely on hold for the time being. So, yeah, it's very different.
It is very different. I want to ask you one thing we didn't talk about before, and that is the camera you're using.
Sure.
And we didn't get there. We talked about the bike, but we didn't talk about the camera. So you say you take a tripod with you. Clearly, it's a digital camera now. Nobody uses film anymore, unless you do. You don't use film anymore.
No. It's all digital. I use a Canon 5D Mark IV. It's a very nice full-frame camera. And I typically would use a 70 to 200 f2.8 lens, although I have a wide-angle zoom that I use as well.
Hmm.
Those two lenses really, I have other lenses, but there's limits to what one wants to carry.
Right, right.
Then I have a tripod that the legs fold back on itself, so it's quite compact, so I can lay it across the rear rack, lash it with a bungee cord, and then I put the camera gear in a backpack. I keep a couple of spare jerseys and spare caps, different colors, because I want to be ready for different backdrops. So I plan these things pretty well in advance, but you still have things that you I have a heavy enough pack as it is.
What kind of backpack is it?
It's a Low Pro. It's called a Flip Side, which works really, really well for what I'm doing, because you open the backpack on the side that's next to your back. So when I put the pack down in the dirt or mud or whatever, because, you know, in the winter it's going to be muddy and wet.
Right.
That part is not going to be on my back. So my clothes stay clean, which I want for a lot of reasons, not least of which would be the visual. You don't look so clever when you're riding through with big mud streaks down your back. So you want to look good in the pictures. That's a backpack that works particularly well for what I'm doing.
Such an interesting life you're leading. What else do you do when you aren't doing this?
Sleep.
yeah, we're all sleeping a lot.
I'm working on a children's book. I have an idea about a children's book based on stories that I told my kids when they were a little character that we have. And my youngest daughter, especially, she's now 17, but we still joke about this little character. And so I'm working on a book about that, and I'm also trying my hand at doing a kind of a lighthearted adventure novel set in the 20s, which it makes me laugh anyway.
Because laughter right now is about all we can come up with to keep us sane. So
yes.
I would like you to tell my listeners how they can find your work and how they can follow you as you continue to make these little journeys from your back door.
Sure. It's easy to find. My Instagram account is simply my name, the @ and @RoffSmith. My website is called theartoftheride.com. Although I've actually linked it, I've made another domain called Travels at Home, which I've linked to it, which seems to be easier to find. So that will work too.
Well, I found The Art of the Ride pretty quickly. That wasn't too hard. That wasn't too hard.
Less the type if you're just... if you're just typing it in.
Yeah. Well, I really appreciate you taking time to talk with me and to tell us about your journeys from home. They're just fascinating. The photography is breathtaking. Thank you so much. I know it's late where you are. We're at 11 here, so you're at already like dinner time.
That's exactly right.
It's dinner time. We've been speaking with Roff Smith. He is an award-winning photographer and writer. He does a lot of work with National Geographic, although now he's sitting at home in Hastings in the UK and doing beautiful work right from his door. Thank you so much. Stay safe and stay well.
Thank you.
All right. Take care. Roff Smith joined me from his home in the UK. If you are interested in seeing the Art of the Ride photos from his Journeys from Home pages, you can log on to artoftheride.com or follow Roff on his journeys at Roff Smith on Instagram. So let's take a short break, and when we come back, we'll speak with People for Bikes, Noah Banyan. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
We are back. I'm Diane Jenks, and you are listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. If we are to believe everything we read or hear in the news today, you would think that absolutely zero gets done in Washington, D.C. But surprise, surprise, there are actually bills being introduced and laws being passed, and People for Bikes' Noah Banyan is the lady who keeps her ear to the ground and helps to further the progress of the bike industry's wants and needs on Capitol Hill. Hi, Noah. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for being my guest on the show.
Thanks. Happy to be on the show. Appreciate it.
You are social distancing really far from Washington right now.
I am. It's nice to be able to do federal policy work from northern Minnesota right now.
I guess. It sounds awesome. I'd like you to explain what you do. What is the Federal Affairs Manager at People for Bikes?
my job, I'm generally based in DC, is to help strategize and push forward policies that will ultimately benefit the bike industry and, you know, the millions of people across the country who ride bikes. So we push for things like increased infrastructure funding to help get better bike lanes in your community. We focus on trade policies too, because that affects the bike industry and our membership within the trade association. And we look at public lands and recreation and how can we make all experiences of biking better and help people find more joy on two wheels.
And we all know there is more joy on two wheels. There is no question yes. about that. One of the things I wanted to talk about was we talk about an infrastructure bill every so often. It comes up for renewal. It's a transportation bill that comes up for renewal. But there are some things coming out of DC right now in regards to both transportation and infrastructure projects and some really good news, which we could all use right about now. Tell us a little bit about what's happening, and especially there's a new Great American Outdoors program that just got reauthorized too, I think.
Yeah, no, that's a really exciting one. It's not the Congress you might have anticipated to be passing some really fantastic, impressive public lands funding commitments, but we're excited about it. So 2 weeks ago, I believe, the House passed the Great American Outdoors Act. The Senate had already passed it, and the president has made his commitment to signing it into law clear. I think we'll see that happening as early as Tuesday of next week. But what all that means is the Great American Outdoors Act will authorize annual permanent funding for the Land and Water Conservation Fund. And to break that down even more, that means that there's no longer an annual debate on whether and how much to fund the Land and Water Conservation Fund. But the Land and Water Conservation Fund is LWCF, to shorten it a bit, is one of the most, if not the most successful conservation and recreation lands program in our nation's history. It was founded in 1964 to dedicate everything from the federal procurement of land for the purpose of conservation and recreation to helping build local soccer fields, to single track trails in national forest lands, to, you know, helping boost our public lands from federal, state, local in every sense. So now we're looking at $900 million a year that's promised and dedicated to the LWCF. That's up from about, you know, on average, $300 to $400 million a year. It's going to be a huge boost to your favorite places to get outside. So we're really excited about that. It also helps with the deferred maintenance backlog on our public lands. It's just redirecting funds from energy development on federal lands to the maintenance backlog. So all these projects that have been pushed aside, from servicing visitor centers to trail maintenance, international parks and other public lands, will now have a new source of funding to help combat those projects.
Let me take a moment to remind our listeners, we're speaking with Noah Bannion from the People for Bikes organization. Are you still headquartered in Colorado, or are you only in D.C. now?
No, that's correct. I am the D.C. office of People for Bikes, and we are headquartered in Boulder, Colorado.
Okay, you are. Okay, so yes. She's speaking, and of course, we're speaking to her from Minnesota, so nothing is nothing is exactly as it seems. I also want to talk about this U.S. House Select Committee on the Climate Crisis and their report. What were some of the findings and proposals in that committee?
Right. So this is another exciting, you know, it's not a law, it's not a bill, it's just research that was done with the help of, you know, other agencies and scientific groups. But in that report from this select committee, there's a 547-page report. So certainly not short, not necessarily your light summer reading, but it's exciting to see in the report climate taken so seriously, and the changes that we need to make as a society, as an industry, to make sure that we're leaving our favorite places to be outside, or even just to work and to live better for next generation. So in the 547-page report, there is a pretty robust section on transportation. You may have heard there was a pretty popular or widespread government study done a few years ago that 28% of greenhouse gas emissions in the United States come from transportation. And a large section of that 28%, I think it's 59%, are specifically from like automotive vehicles. And we know also that most trips that people take in cars are under, you know, 5 miles or 20 minutes or something like that. And in many places can be easily replaced by a bike if you have the right infrastructure around. So in that sense, you know, investing in bike infrastructure is a climate concern. And what this report did was recognize that for the first time, I think, really at the federal level, that when you build better bike infrastructure, when you make it more accessible to bike for more Americans, we're going to reduce the amount of greenhouse gas emissions that we put out, and we're going to increase the amount of carbon neutral transportation that's happening. People are still going to get where they need to go and continue to live their lives, and we're going to be doing it in a cleaner, greener, more fun way if you're on a bike, to be quite honest.
It's so amazing to me that we've been talking about this for years and years and years. This is not a new conversation about short trips, take your bike, walk, don't get in your car. But now it seems to have gathered some steam, and it's starting to actually show up as going to be making a difference. So it's really exciting. The other thing I want to talk about, of course, is the transportation bill, always a work in progress. And it seems to always be either pushed aside or some sort of patchwork is, you know, put on it, and it kind of sort of passes. So this transportation bill seems to have some pretty juicy things for cycling. And is the bill going to get out of committee and get passed this year? Always a good question.
Right. That's a perennial question with Congress. So the good news is that in the House, the transportation bill actually passed the entire House. It was included in a broader infrastructure package that also included some awesome provisions for bikes and new definitions and funding. And that actually passed out of the House this month. But, you know, there's two chambers in Congress, the House and the Senate, and they need to work together to get things done, which is where things get a little bit dicey. Last July, the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee passed their own version of a transportation bill. And at the time, and still, it is, it provides more robust funding for programs where bike facilities are eligible. It has a climate title that's supported. It has bipartisan support, and that's for the first time in a transportation bill history. And it does a lot to increase accessibility of funding for local planning agencies. So that passed just in the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee. It has not gone to the Senate floor, and that would be the next step before the House and Senate can sit down together and hash out some of the differences in their bill. You might know that the current statute, the FAST Act, is set to expire at the end of September. So there is certainly a deadline that everyone in Congress is aware of, and there's pressure to do something on infrastructure because of its potential to help stimulate the economy. But given other major concerns and provisions and relief needs that are happening in Congress, it seems like we might be dealing with another extension of current funding, which is what people who have followed transportation bills will be familiar with, is there's almost always an extension,
right?
Because the deadline just isn't met.
So one of the things that is coming around again is this commuter piece. Finally, it was in place and then it went away, and now it's coming back again. Does it look different from what it was before? I think it used to be $20 a month or something. So
right.
That's what I remember.
Yeah. So that there used to be a bike commuter benefit. You're right. I think $19 or $20 a month. And that was a reimbursement.
Right.
And then that went away. That was suspended in the 2017 Tax Act that passed. So we've been without one for a bit. And what is really exciting about this House infrastructure package is that it does include a bill that we've been supporting since the commuter benefit was suspended, to both reinstate the bike commuter benefits. So let's get it back. Let's give people a little bit of money in their pockets for commuting to work, and let's expand it. So what we're looking at now, what could potentially happen if this version is to pass, is far and away better than your $20 a month reimbursement. This is up to $54 a month in pre-tax benefits, which adjusts for inflation. It can be used for bike share. It can be used for e-bikes. It can be used in harmony with your parking, with your transit benefits as well. So it's not, you know, you have to ride your bike every day of the month to get it. We know people get to work, you know, many different ways. And especially now, you know, we want to make sure that we're incentivizing people to take safe, socially distanced, efficient ways to get around, to get back to work as we're on that track. And I think putting a little bit of money up to $54 a month in a commuter's pocket to help them get to the bus station by bike or to, you know, bike a couple days a week and maybe ride share with someone in their household or what have you, it gives commuters that flexibility that wasn't there in the original benefit. And obviously, $54 compared to 20 is a much better.
It is. So one of the things that I think is really important for people who listen to the show is knowing how to let their voices be heard in these issues. Transportation bill, the climate crisis issue, the commuter reimbursement benefits. What do you suggest for people if they can't join a committee, you know, or join an organization like People for Bikes, which of course anybody can do that, and we highly recommend that they do. But what can they do to have their voices heard on the Hill?
That's a great question. And, you know, I'll always say this, it's free to call your member of Congress. And they're technically in the business of customer service, with you as their constituent, telling them what's important to you, telling them what policies matter, what changes in your community would improve your community and help your neighbors and help you get around. That is always good information to share. And that's, you know, when you have specifics or when you just want to say, I think this program needs to be funded. We have, you know, as many phone scripts as you would like. We have email drafts. You can look up your member of Congress online. You can reach out to us, and we're always more than happy to help you connect. You know, we usually do fly-ins throughout the year where we bring people from the bike industry and our advocates to DC to talk to their member of Congress. Obviously, that's not happening now in the pandemic, but they're still just as accessible online, if not even more. You know, I always recommend it's a great practice to get into is reaching out to your district office, to your state office, and as their constituent, letting them know what's important to you.
Is a phone call better than an email? Or is a letter better than a phone call?
I think that's a great question. You know, if I actually had the answer to that, my job might be a little easier. I think it's whatever works for you. It'll get read. It'll get processed. When you're on the phone, you're talking to someone immediately and they're taking notes, but it might not be the exact person that needs to hear it.
That's
granted,
true.
They'll send that note up to the right staff person, the legislative assistant that handles those issues. Sending snail mail, you know, we've all got a little extra time on our hands, and I think that's really appreciated on the Hill. There's so many emails that go in their inboxes that it just gets a little bit harder to track because they're hearing from lobbyists, they're hearing from industries, they're hearing from colleagues and their constituents. So I think if you've got time to write a letter, then go for it. That would be awesome. And I am more than happy to help someone draft that. But yeah, I think phone calls, letters, emails, all of it are accessible, useful ways of getting in touch with your elected officials.
Well, we are on the cusp of a very important election, and I wanted to make sure that certain pieces of what's going on in Congress are available to the people who listen to the show. So if you are interested in what Noah and I have been talking about, you can go to peopleforbikes.org, and there's tons of information. So we've been talking with Noah Banion. She is the Federal Affairs Manager for People for Bikes. She's usually in DC. She's in Minnesota right now. Please, 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 if you are interested, find out more about what you can do as we get closer and closer to this November election. Thank you, Noah.
Thank you, Diane. Appreciate the opportunity.
All right. Have a great afternoon. Enjoy Minnesota.
I will. Take care.
Okay. Bye.
Okay. Bye.
Noah Banion is the Federal Affairs Manager for People for Bikes. If you are interested in learning more about the organization, want to contact your legislators with something that's on your mind as it pertains to transportation or recreation, or you want to join People for Bikes, log on to peopleforbikes.org. So we're going to take another short break, and when we come back, we'll learn all about Sea Otter 2020. It's almost time to play.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm Diane Jenks. Madison Geiger and Sarah Timlick are two of my Sea Otter peeps, and they're here to talk with me about the new platform that the organization has put together for 2020. Hello, Sarah and Madison. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. So I want to preface our conversation by telling you who's who and what's what. Madison is the project manager for Sea Otter Play, and that's what we're going to talk about today. Sarah is the expo sales director, and that's part of what we're going to talk about today. As everybody might remember, I was the podcast media sponsor. I guess I still am technically for Sea Otter, which has been postponed till 2021, but we have a whole new platform for everybody to participate in. So who wants to start?
Well, I'm happy to start, and Madison can correct me when I take a misstep.
Okay, Sarah.
Madison's really been just doing an incredible effort putting this whole thing together for us. Obviously, when we had to make the sad decision to cancel Sea Otter in October, we had to pivot quickly, and Madison just did an incredible job sourcing out an incredible tool that would allow us to deliver a truly virtual event to thousands and thousands of consumers who would normally be coming out to celebrate at Laguna Seca and enjoy everything cycling. So we sort of launched into overdrive, and we were able to find a company in the U.S. that has been doing virtual events for many years. And what's kind of interesting and what I think we've all learned is that virtual events have been sort of more standard in the high-tech business. Apparently in Europe, they've been going for quite a while as well. So we sort of immersed ourselves in this technology, and we're working with a company called Six Connects, and we literally have a virtual cycling festival that will happen on September 17th. It's going to be prefaced by some really exciting cycling challenges, and I think maybe the first thing to do is start off by talking a little bit about the cycling challenges, and I think that and how they work and who we're targeting. And I think, Madison, if you want to cover that and talk a little bit about how the cycling challenges work, that would be great.
Yeah, I'm happy to. So the cycling challenges will happen between September 1st and September 16th. And we have six different distance-based challenges as well as one kids challenge. That would be riding a certain amount of time per day over the 16 days. So we're really excited about them. We'll have everything from a shorter distance that can be done on a mountain bike or an e-bike to longer distance challenges that can be done over the course of the 16 days and all the way up to a challenge that's for the total miles logged in that amount of time. And these challenges, the exciting part about them is they can be done on any form of activity. So it can be biking, hiking, running, anything that you like, but just trying to get people out there during these times and really enjoying the outdoors. And then at the end of the challenges, we'll also be giving access into a virtual swag bag, which we've partnered with a lot of our brands to have some great discounts and giveaways through that, as well as it'll link into something that we have going on in gaming and prizes on the platform. So anyone that performs in one of these challenges and gets their completion certificate at the end will have a head start in our gaming on the platform that'll start on September 17th. So they should be a great way worldwide that people can participate, track how they're doing compared to others, and really create a community in that.
So let me ask a question real quickly. This online platform is specific to Sea Otter Play. So it's not like you're partnering with somebody like Strava or Zwift or any of them. This is your own platform. Is that what I'm understanding?
So the challenges will be run through a program called Run Sign Up. You will log your distance on any type of GPS device, or you can manually insert any distance that you have for a specific day. That information will get inserted onto the platform called Run Sign Up. And those challenges happen before the festival. Then when the festival starts, it's through the Six Connects platform, and that's a Sea Otter Play specific platform. Everything to do with Sea Otter Play, and it'll look kind of like the Sea Otter Classic when you enter the lobby.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Sarah Timlick and Madison Geiger. We're talking about a new platform for Sea Otter for 2020. Tell us a little bit about the expo, Sarah, and what's going to be happening, because that was one of the biggest reasons I was coming out there, was to talk to all these great vendors and get these little vignettes of what they were doing and what they thought about Sea Otter, besides talking to attendees. So who will be part of your expo, and how will that show up on the platform?
Sure. As a consumer, whether I'm an athlete and I've participated in the challenges or whether I'm just a regular consumer, when I come to Sea Otter Play, I just have to register. And this is key. It's free. Anybody can register and check it out. So I just have to log in using my email and agree to some terms and conditions, and I'm into Sea Otter Play. And when I get there, I see this incredible landing page, and it looks so neat. It's got the swale background of Laguna Seca. You can even see the dual slalom in the background. It looks and feels like Laguna Seca. There's the iconic tire bridge. You can see all these areas visually represented within this page that makes me feel like I'm kind of a sea otter. There's a kids area. There's expo tents that are grouped around the lake, in the lake bed. There's the paddock. So as a consumer, I have multiple places that I can go. Kind of imagine like it's like a bit of a video game vibe, to tell you the truth. When you first get there, you feel like you're sort of immersed in this really cool kind of video game version of Sea Otter. So you can decide where you want to go. And then I might want to go to the expo. I can click on the expo and I can see and view all the exhibitors alphabetically. And they're going to be grouped together sort of, A to G, H to M, et cetera, et cetera. So I can do one of two things. I can go visit our sponsor hall, where all of our fantastic sponsors will be located. And we've had sponsors decide that they want to partake in Sea Otter Play on some level, such as Bosch, Specialized, Continental Tire, Giant and Live, just some terrific brands that are involved on a sponsorship level with this. So I can go to the sponsor hall. And if I go to the sponsor hall, or I go to the exhibitor hall and I visit an exhibitor where I could see brands like Maxis and Wahoo, Niner and Pivot. If I'm going to the exhibitor hall or the sponsor hall, I'm actually going to see booths. And this is what's incredible, and it's very hard to describe on the phone, but you actually see a booth, and the booth looks great. It feels very much like a Sea Otter booth. It's got kind of a cool white tent and lighting. And then you've got all these different branding opportunities for companies. So there's everything you typically see in a booth. There's banners, there's video players, you name it. And as a consumer, I can then engage with that brand by clicking on any one of those content boxes. And they can lead me into this world of product knowledge by showcasing all of their terrific products and services through their marketing content. So there may be a real cool image in one banner of a video. In fact, I was just on a phone call just before I jumped on with you guys talking to a kid's helmet brand. And they were saying, oh, it'd be really great if I could have like the picture of the kid's helmet. And then, it shows that this is a video about why kids' head protection matters. And I click on that, and up would come a video player with the video where they could tell me all about the importance of sizing the helmet for my child and why their helmet offers superior protection. And then as a consumer, I can even have a deeper level of engagement with that brand through chat. I can private chat, and the company representative who will be manning the booth at the kind of the back end of the system can chat back to me. So I could say, hey, I love this XYZ helmet. Where can I buy it? There's also a public chat opportunity. So exhibitors or sponsors have the opportunity to do like a Q&A, you know, come to our booth Saturday at 1 o'clock and learn everything you want to learn about e-bike technology, for example, and that could be a public chat. So the booths are just filled with opportunities for brands to connect with consumers through great videos, through brochures, through product photos, and really engage through these chat sort of options. Does that kind of give you a good picture of what it's all about?
I think it does. We're going to take a real quick break, and when we come back, we're going to speak with Sarah and Madison some more about Sea Otter Play. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm Diane Jenks. We are speaking with Sarah Timlick and Madison Geiger from the Sea Otter Expo Play. So the expo really isn't happening the way it usually does. I think wasn't it originally in April? Like the real Sea Otter? Yeah, okay. And now we're going to have this big virtual to-do, which is kind of cool. So Madison, I have a question about the challenges. So once these challenges begin, how do we know, this is just like, okay, you're either being honest or you're not, but how do we know how these people are tracking? Do they have to upload from a GPS device?
Our uploads will be a bit on the honor system. Of course, we would prefer for uploads to come from a GPS device. You'll be able to download the GPX file and upload it right on to run sign up. But we know some people don't have access to that, and we really want to be inclusive of everyone, whether they've ever ridden a bike before or not. So there will be opportunities to manually submit your miles as well.
Very, very cool. So what else should we know about the challenges? I think that that's where my listeners are going to try to jump in. I mean, I think they will go to the expo, but I'm just wondering what kind of challenges are going to be out there.
Yeah, so something to consider on the challenges is we're really making this a global event. The Sea Otter Classic has four different events. So there's Sea Otter Europe, Sea Otter Canada, Sea Otter Australia, and the Sea Otter Classic, which happens in Monterey. And then through our Sea Otter Play platform, we really wanted to include all of our brands. So in these challenges, we have a few different routes that you can participate in. So we have something called the Canadian Gravel Grinder, which will be a 63-mile or 100-kilometer adventure, highlighting the vistas and valleys along the Niagara Escarpment. And so that will be really exciting. We have a Costa Capital, a Cycla Brava challenge. So they're really coming from a global perspective. And what'll be fun on these challenges is you can actually see the route that you would be riding in a physical environment. And you can compare where you are on the route to the rider next to you. So where you're not physically riding that route, you get a good idea day by day of where you would be on it and whether that's something you could do physically in the future as well.
Interesting. So something we have not talked about, but I think it's a really important part of the Sea Otter Play is the charities. There are charities that will stand to benefit from all these activities. How will they benefit and who are the charities?
We have had some great interest from some charitable partners. We have everyone from the Community Foundation for Monterey County's COVID Relief Fund to Cycling Canada involved in terms of charity partners. We really think that it's important to have this aspect of our event, especially in the times that we're in right now, is quite a challenge for everyone out there and really wanted to put out some support through our platform for some of these different charities. So we'll have a full list of charities on August 14th when our website goes live, but that gives a good taste of our starting point for what we're looking for. And attendees and exhibitors as well, athletes, they'll all be able to donate through either our store or through the Run Sign Up platform. We'll have a charity component of that as well. So we're really excited to help fundraise worldwide, whether it's Cycling Canada or the COVID Relief Fund in Monterey County.
People who are participating in Sea Otter Play can choose to donate. Are vendors also looking to help support the charities?
Absolutely. There will be different opportunities to donate, and athletes will have the chance to donate as they register. And we'll have easy access from the platform for both exhibitors and attendees once we get into the expo and festival component as well.
Excellent. So how many vendors are already signed up for the expo, Sarah?
So we have over 100 that are going to be participating, so far in the expo. It's a big shift in thinking for the entire industry. But what I've found is that the majority of exhibitors are excited about the new opportunity. Everybody understands that, you know, what makes the otter amazing and great is that sort of in-person touch, feel, try the product piece. But everyone also understands that's just not possible right now.
Right.
And that Sea Otter Play is offering a really safe and great alternative for consumers to still get all that product knowledge and still learn what's new and what's out there and, you know, what products, you know, could really benefit and improve their ride or help, you know, make their kids more safe just through this virtual environment and from the comfort of their home. So everyone, you know, for the most part, has been incredibly supportive. The other thing about Sea Otter Play is it's completely free. So anybody can create, basically sign on and come to Sea Otter Play, and it doesn't cost anybody a dime to attend.
Let me ask a kind of a weird question. Given the state of the industry right now, where there seems to be a lack of product in a lot of categories, bike shops are stripped bare, vendors to bike shops don't necessarily have product, is anybody saying to you, I won't be ready by September? Or are they saying, yeah, we're hoping that the pipeline's filled back up?
Yeah, it depends. You know, it really depends on who I'm talking to. And, you know, there's obviously a big difference between whether I'm, you know, a manufacturer of bicycles or I have soft goods or protective equipment or helmets. But that doesn't really seem to be a big concern on the part of most companies. I think they're figuring out the supply chain and they're getting through it and they're solving problems. I think what they're really looking at doing is just continuing to have that meaningful engagement with consumers that they would typically get at Sea Otter. I mean, exhibitors come to Sea Otter year after year because they are able to really have meaningful conversations with consumers, get great feedback on products, get that sort of conversation going, and create brand enthusiasts. The other part of this, too, is the business-to-business component. So Sea Otter, over the past couple of years, has really evolved because there's so much business that gets done at Sea Otter. And that's another thing that, you know, is top of mind when I'm talking to exhibitors. Can I connect with other exhibitors in this environment? You can't. There's really neat aspects. There's business card drops. There's the private chat. You know, Sea Otter is known for bringing the industry all together in one place to conduct the cycling business and then to just have all of the passionate brand consumers enjoying all of the different aspects of cycling and engaging with their favorite brands. We're going to do that again, obviously, when it's safe to do so at Laguna Seca. But right now, our Sea Otter Play offers that. It's this great online experience where everyone can get all together, albeit in a digital world, and do what they do at Sea Otter, which is engage and learn and connect. So we're excited about that aspect.
So as I remember, Bicycle Leadership Conference usually is somehow connected to Sea Otter, BLC. So is that going to happen?
So, no, I'm not an expert on that part of it.
Okay.
But you bring up a really good point, is our content stadium. You know, one of the things that's really going to drive attendance and attract consumers and people from the cycling business at the same time is our tremendous content we're going to offer on our stage throughout the weekend. So starting on September 17th, straight through to the 20th, we're going to have all these great live streaming seminars, and we're going to have content that you can't see anywhere else before Sea Otter Play. So the new Warren Miller Entertainment film is going to premiere on Sea Otter Play. We're going to have really high-level, athlete-focused content like training during a pandemic and the psychology around that. How do you continue to train positively as an athlete when all your races are canceled? That kind of content, live athlete performances brought to us by some of our sponsors. So it's going to have really exciting content. It's going to entertain consumers. It's going to inform consumers. It's going to excite consumers. And it's really going to, again, you know, try and, to the best of our ability in a virtual environment, mimic all of that excitement and stoke, as people like to say about theater.
Yes, pivot and stoke. Those are the two words this year. Well, Madison and Sarah, I really appreciate you taking time to talk with me. I know you guys are rushing to get everything done in short order. So somebody tell me And tell my listeners, again, the dates, how to get involved, what are the websites, and what should people be looking to do?
All right. Well, a great place to start is on seaotterplay.com. It will have all of the information that you need. Our registration starts on August 14th for all events, whether it's challenges or the festival. So check it out on August 14th or now. We have it up and going, but there will be more information then. And follow along on our Sea Otter Classic social media, Instagram, Facebook. Again, the event dates, the challenges will be starting September 1st and run through September 16th. And our festival will be September 17th through 20th. So put September 1st through 20th on the calendar, and we're excited to see everyone there.
We've been speaking with Madison Geiger. She's the project manager for Sea Otter Play. And Sarah Timlick, she's the expo sales director and clearly knows everything that's going on about the expo. Thank you so much for talking with me. I'll see you at Sea Otter Play.
Thank you so much. We appreciate the time.
You have a great
day. Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
If you're interested in participating in Sea Otter Play, you can register for the challenges beginning August 14th. And spend some time on the website to learn about products, attend seminars, or chat with some of the pros and vendors. You can find out more at seaotterplay.com. That's the Outspoken Cyclist for this week. Thanks to all my guests, and thanks to you for listening. I'll be back next week with a brand new edition of the Outspoken Cyclist. And in the meantime, stay safe, stay well, wear your mask, wash your hands, and remember, if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on the Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening. Ride safely, and we'll see you next week.